This week on Webcomics Weekly, we discuss the tone of our new podcast, discuss our webcomic pet peeves, and the gang gives you each our tips and tricks for the week. All this week on Webcomics Weekly, number one. All right, so before we, start recording officially, Dave, you wanted to discuss what what this whole Webcomics Weekly podcast was going to be about. I think you'd mentioned, like, what does it mean for everybody?
I think we need to talk about it.
Yeah, just for, like, if our overarching goal, are we talking to a 10-year-old, a 20-year-old, a 30-year-old, you know what I mean? Like, what, you know what I mean, in terms of difference of thematics?
I think, though, like, for our book, don't we want to talk to, like, the late high school, in college, kind of semi-good at what he's doing?
Well, here's the thing. I think we need to be able to cast a wide net. In other words, some of the stuff is going to go over the 15-year-olds' heads, but I remember being 15 and reading those books, and even though some of it went over my head, I still wanted it.
You wanted to catch up.
Yes.
You weren't just like, forget
this. So I think
this.
We should aim it squarely at, you know, 25-year-olds, but know that we're hitting 18, 15, and maybe all the way up to 50, depending. But
I agree with that.
And I think we should keep it clean. This should have the clean tag on it.
Mm-hmm.
And but no, I think we should aim it at pretty much, I think we should shoot for the middle, and then the experienced people will just have to deal with the fact that there's some 101 stuff in there, and the young kids will meet the challenge of catching up.
Okay, fair enough. So what you're saying then is 9 to 99.
Thanks for calling.
See you later.
See you later.
Long time, first time.
Dave, you'd asked a question when we were talking earlier, like what is everyone individually hope to accomplish with the podcast? I thought that was a good question. That I'm asking.
No, it wasn't a good question.
Chris, what do you want to do with this podcast?
Well, number one, I think that as much fun as it is, I don't want to talk about drama. It's worthless.
No drama.
This is purely professional, but like sharing tips and stuff is important. You know what I mean? Like whatever we wanted to do with that book, our focus for that book,
yeah,
should be something that we can do.
Which I think the focus of the book is actually practically making something that people can use that is only discussing making comics and making it work and doesn't really address the community or any of the social aspects.
No, we
of
need
it.
To be talking about interesting things that other cartoonists are doing,
but
stuff
it
that
ends,
we liked.
It ends at the work. It begins and ends at the work.
Yes.
So this for you, the podcast, this podcast is about the work.
It should be, yeah.
Good. What about you? What about you, Dave?
I think that's true. For me, what this podcast is about is between the four of us, we have a pretty solid shared base of knowledge about traditional comics, print comics, the transition between them, and then eventually into web comics, both in running your own show and in working with different conglomerates, you know what I mean? And so I think between the four of us, we have a good range of knowledge that for kids and young professionals nowadays, there's no book out there that can address what the four of us can address, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what it is to me. It's basically everything that comic book was, Your Career in the Comics, Nordling's book there.
Oh yeah, I remember that book.
Everything that book was, plus some cartooning tips for I'm going to say a 25-year-old, you know.
Am I at a loss for not having read that book?
It's not like you're behind now because you didn't, but it was That Lee Nordling book was interesting because it was basically just a bunch of collections of recollections and opinions and interviews of people that ran the gamut from that were to the syndicate to the cartoonists to editors to the lawyers. And they all had some little nugget of inside information in their own little perspective. So you should read it. It's a fun read.
When did it come out? When did it come out?
Long time ago. I don't even know if it's still in print. Is it still in print, Dave, that Lee Nordling book?
Yeah, it's not even it's not even in any current print list. You have to get it on like Amazon.
You can find it on Amazon or eBay. It's called Your Career in Comics. It's a strangely sized book. It's very like thin and tall.
Here's how to make your first step. contact your editor via daguerreotype.
Chris, though, as much as the tendency is to make fun of it, though, there were some nuggets of, like, interesting tidbits from people. I mean, some people were like, you know, follow your dreams, and, like, great, that helps me out a lot, you know. But then there were other people that talked about, like, the serious considerations of how much do you modify your original concepts, how much do you continue at them and just let people eventually figure it out, and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
It is a good book. It's definitely up there as... If you're going to do cartooning, any cartooning, whether it's the web or print, that is a must read.
Hmm.
You should get it, Chris. I'll try to find it.
Yeah, you know what? In fact, one thing that might be good in this initial episode is let's acknowledge already existing things that are out there that are worthwhile to look at if you're in, you know.
So before we get too far off the beaten path, Brad, what is it that you hope this podcast accomplishes for you?
Well, for me, I'm thinking... You know, back when we were kids, all of us, you know, there was that mythical Marvel bullpen. And for me, this is kind of like if I were able to sit in on John Byrne and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko all talking shop talk, what paper they were using, what styles they were looking at, and theories that they were trying to put into test. This would be that kind of a thing that people could actually listen in on.
That is awesome.
Who has to be Byrne?
You know, it's just all shop talk. It's got nothing to do with the gossip that's going on and the personalities and stuff like that. But it's just a bunch of guys sitting around talking about, you know, their craft.
Yeah.
That is neat that you had mentioned the bullpen and stuff, because we were talking about that this week over at Kirkman's house, and I was reading a bunch of interviews about the old Marvel bullpen. And actually, someone recently posted pictures to that they took at Comic-Con 1982. And boy, man, it's just so different. Everything is so different now. And they're really, you look back and you remember how things were with the bullpen and the Fumetti comics and all the behind-the-scenes stuff that used to happen in the 70s and 80s. And there isn't that for web comics. It's
right.
Well, let me say real quick what I want it to be. I really want, and this is also with the book, I really think that, you know, I've said in the past, we need to be careful who we elect as our representatives for webcomics. And what I'd really like this podcast to do is to reclaim the term webcomics so that it now applies to the craft and it also applies to this almost exciting feeling of this new frontier to explore, and take the term back for the new people coming in, as opposed to having webcomics be a label for this existing community that's kind of
cranky.
Yeah, in my opinion, really cranky and kind of fallen from grace a bit. And I include myself in that group. I really think this is about taking that term and reclaiming it and saying, webcomics is this new thing that is the future of the comic book and the comic strip, and it's, you know, it's something to be excited about. It's uncharted. It's waiting to be defined by the generation coming up, you know, and reclaim what it means, because right now that term defines this kind of cranky community that we're all, frankly, I think, sick of. But anyway, awesome. So I mean, I really think that that being kind of free form and conversational is better than saying, "All right, guys. Well, here are the topics we picked this week. What does everyone think about quill pens and inking with quill pens?"
But I think we're going to need that, too, because it'll be real easy for us to be like, what are we doing?
No, I know that. And creative editing will prevent that from becoming too obvious. But
what's the thoughts on taking questions from the listeners? I mean, as far as like them writing in a question.
Yes, not live.
Yeah, no, I think a written question would be great, actually.
I think they
and
should.
And then we might have a bunch of stuff to fall back on when that conversation lags.
I think that is a great
incredible
source of
segment.
Content.
I think it is. And so I think we should absolutely have that. So, hey, should we register Webcomics Weekly?
What, as a website?
Yeah.
I don't see why not. Hold on, let's go look. I'm sure it's available.
We could just do webcomics weekly at halfpixel.com if we need to in a pinch. Just have an email address for them to send it to.
Yeah, we could always do that. Let's see.
Or we can make a forum.
Oh, it's taken.
It is?
.com is taken.
What? What's at Webcomics Weekly?
I don't know. Let's find out.
Chris, we can just make a forum in Half Pixel.
It is a, it seems like it's some kind of a collective, maybe. Hold on, let's find out.
So every week we're going to have topics that we each bring to the to the table. And Brad, did Dave tell you that I think it's a great idea that every week we have a tip?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Do any of you have kind of in the back of your heads any topics that you wanted to discuss this time around, this go around?
One thing that might be a good idea is for us to kind of break up, maybe, I'm just spitballing here, the conversation into, like, start out with just a real novice tip. Because if I see one more webcomic out there that the panels butt up against each other without a gutter in between them, you know, I'm going to scream. And I think it might be a good idea just to spend maybe the first 5 minutes just talking about really, really 101 type of thing.
Hey, let's do a segment real quick on webcomics or on comic pet peeves, like the craft. Because the craft is really important. And you were saying, like, panels that butt up against each other?
Right.
Are you talking about gutterless panels?
Exactly.
Can anybody make that work? Does anybody really make that work?
No, that's why it's a pet peeve.
Are you talking about, like, the line width on the characters is like 0.5 and then the panel's width is 0.5?
He's talking about
if you have a four-panel comic, you've got three gutters in between those panels.
Right.
Some people leave those gutters up or leave those gutters out and the panels munch up against each other.
Yeah, in other words, it's one big long panel and then you divide it with one
line. No, I'm just saying that they just drew a line down.
Yeah.
They didn't make a box.
Surely someone has made that work.
Well, I'm saying
if you've seen it work.
You could have a thick...
As soon as you've got a background in there where you've got a vertical line that goes top to bottom like a wall or something, now you've got lines that are acting like panel divisions that are actually backgrounds.
No, he's right.
But what about
there's actually a term in fine art for that, where it's the symmetry of lines that touch one another. It fools the eye and confuses it, and so that gutter creates a space where the eye can sort of relax and adjust to a new image, which is the new panel.
What about a really thick black line to differentiate it?
I think it's still.
Then you have
work.
A negative. It doesn't work?
You know what's really funny is when I was looking through some of my old college strips this weekend, or not this weekend. Why did I say that?
All the time.
Recently. And when I used to draw my panels, are you guys ready for this? With tape.
Tape?
Yeah, there was a really thin black tape. It was called border tape. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
So that you could put a border around your art on an art board.
Oh.
And so I would take it and I'd go zzz, and then that would be the line.
They used that at newspapers for compositional before they went to digital all the time. It was actually pretty great stuff.
Yeah, so I have strips that are made of border tape, but it was one big long box, and then I would just go down. And those strips, when I look at them, are the ones I really hate the most. And I wonder if that's why. But Brad, Dave, that symmetry of line thing, I had an issue with that on today's PvP because my character's in a jail cell. And
right.
And in the top right corner of the first panel is the window looking outside. So you got that small window with the bars, then the gutter, and then the next panel is a close-up of the bars from the front of the cell. And it all became really confusing, and it wasn't until I put the bubbles in on top of them that it broke it up and fixed it.
Let me see that. Is that up today?
Yeah, it's already up.
Yeah, I can see where that would happen.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because your eye looks at the image in its entirety. Even while your conscious mind is trying to break it down, your eye and your brain are processing this whole image as a singular image. And so it's taking in grander swoops that you might not even connect between panels and connects them. You know what I mean?
See, this is exactly why it's a good idea for us to go into some of this 101 stuff, because so far this has been a great conversation.
Hey, you know what's one of my big pet peeves?
Are we recording, by the way?
We are. I secretly have been recording because I wanted it to be natural.
Wonderful.
And then, and now that you know, hey, well, let's talk some more about the...
And now they know, and now Dave's like, I also hate bugs in strips. no, I've been recording because Chris and I have learned when we do our podcast that when we do this, let's talk it out before we start. We always wish we had recorded it.
And we wreck it. Because then we don't want to talk about it again.
Yeah.
We plot it out too deeply.
So here is a pet peeve of mine that I've been seeing a lot. Is it that difficult to figure out how to arrange your word balloons so that the person talking is on the top?
That's probably my biggest one.
Man,
there's a lot of scenes, and that's the thing, is that you look at a strip, and number one, you're gonna want the one that's being spoken first to be top and left.
Right.
And then the next one is further down and on the right side.
Yes.
Or further to the right anyway, if you got the space for more. But sometimes there are strips where it's just two talking heads. It's two people talking. And he has placed them, for whatever reason, on opposite sides, even though the guy on the right always talks first. Just switch him.
It makes no sense.
The guy on the left should talk first.
I've seen that in multiple strips.
Here's the most basic tip I can give for actually making that happen. Let's say you have character A speaking first in the first panel and character B speaking second in the first panel. But by the third panel, you need character B to speak first.
That is an issue I have.
The quickest way to do that is in the second panel between those two, you do a close-up one-shot of one of the characters, and that allows you to switch the places or take a different camera angle for the third panel so the second character can speak first.
Have you guys ever tried that?
But then that necessitates drawing them again.
Hey, I wonder if have you heard about that? Where did we see that, Chris? Oh, it was in that Channel 101. They had this imaginary line that you cross.
For what?
When you're filming coverage, and essentially if you're drawing a strip, that's what you're doing. You're filming coverage, just with drawings instead of film. And it's so that you can... Remember how, like, he was saying, I'm talking, and then all of a sudden they switch the angles?
Oh, right.
And it looked like he's no longer talking to the guy?
They always have to be facing kind of the same direction.
You can't... If the conversation starts and you're on this side of them, you can't then move the camera around to that side of them.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. But close-up on one character is a good idea.
But when I have to do that and I end up in that situation, I kind of cheat and I put if the guy on the right side has to talk first, I put his word balloon centered or slightly left, and then I just play with the tails a little bit.
I do that too, and I feel really sloppy.
And
about
I don't
that.
Like doing it either, but it's all I could think of.
Well, there's another way that I've come up with of dealing with this. In the same situation Dave was talking about, sometimes you can get away with this. If that right-hand person has to talk first by the third panel, sometimes if his word balloon is small enough, you can sneak it into the second panel. And so, in other words, if it's a two-word balloon panel in the first panel, sometimes if the sentences are short enough, you can make that a three-word balloon panel in the second panel, and then your order comes out right by the third panel.
That takes guts.
That's true. Well, you know, another way that it just popped into my mind that I've used before as well is, let's say you need that second character to speak first in the third panel. What you do is you change your camera angle slightly so that the second character is still on the right side but very heavily in the foreground, and then the character in the background now is still on the left-hand side but it's actually speaking second with a lower-handed bubble. Does that make sense?
I do. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about lower-handed bubbles?
Keeping it psychologically similar. Like, the characters are still on the same left-right association that they were before, but now
Define.
The character on the right, if he needs to speak first, he's very much in the foreground, and so both he and his voice bubble become prominent and become a natural first.
Oh, you mean bubbles that are below the heads?
I always feel very uncomfortable doing that.
I don't like doing them.
I don't like it.
I feel like he said something else, and I forget to read it.
No, I'm not meaning bubbles below the head. I wish I could point to one specific cartoon imagine two floating voice bubbles, but the trailing tail of the top voice bubble is pointing to the right, or pointing straight down to a character that's heavily in the foreground.
Oh, I understand that.
No,
and then
I agree.
There's a half-sized character that's more in the background that has the lower left-hand side voice bubble.
So that's kind of like what I would do, but more visually to help the reader by creating a background and foreground character.
You guys came up with all very creative solutions to that problem, and it makes my solution seem really stupid.
No words, well, no text.
I always have the character that's, if I have a character that's left and right, and so left is talking first, then right's talking second. If in the next panel, right is going to talk first, and I don't have to go back to the other way, I have that person walking, like indignantly walking and crossing the first guy. And now he's looking back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've done that a bunch.
Well, that's the same as changing a camera angle.
It's no, just I just staging. Have him say, look, now I need to talk first, so I'm going to walk to the left. Like the left side of the panel is having the conch.
Here's another one that's a pretty good one that I've used not too long ago. When that speaking order changes up, I'll change the scene entirely and maybe go to an outside the building shot or maybe an over,
yeah,
something that you don't even see the characters anymore.
That's
I'll
a good
connect
one.
Those two word balloons over top of the two panels, so that it's just a continuation of the narration, and the scene just completely changes altogether.
No, I like that a lot.
Dave, you're really good about that. I need to start doing that more. How do you guys feel about the reverse silhouette or silhouettes?
Love it.
I've been doing it, and I've been enjoying
it.
It's good.
No, I like it a lot, but I think it's got to be used sparingly.
Yeah.
Well, it's just another tool to fiddle with this whole...
I tend to use it for drama purposes and not just two people talking.
Mm-hmm.
If something important is happening where
right.
I want
it's
them to pay attention
good. You
to
know
words.
How, you know how Hitchcock, in like the best scenes that he would craft, it would be like you wouldn't actually see what was happening in a sense. Like he would intentionally leave out a detail of either physical action or a character's face to let you imagine what was actually happening.
Right.
And I think that's what that reverse silhouette does, is that as a cartoonist, you can often show an expression which helps communicate the text. But with that reverse silhouette, you're kind of leaving it up to the reader to decide. And that's why I think it's so effective with drama, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're left guessing what level of anxiety they have on their face.
Well, I always felt like it was...
What level of anger they have on their face.
I almost felt like it was a politeness on the part of the... on the part of the cartoonist to not show this what is a horrible, you know, like sadness or whatever. Like, let's
right,
leave
right,
them
exactly.
now.
You're right. It is sort of a Victorian sort of like, well, we'll look away for a minute kind of thing.
I still think you got to be real careful on that, because I remember it seemed like maybe for a year and a half of reading Doonesbury in a daily newspaper that he fell into this two-panel, third-panel
silhouette yeah.
fourth-panel punchline. And it would be that same thing, talking heads, and there was always that silhouette in the third panel. It
yeah.
was either black on white or white on black, and I think it's a trap that you can fall into.
Yeah, well, I think that is sometimes a case of, well, it takes me 10 seconds to draw a silhouette, takes me 3 minutes to draw the whole panel. I'm drawing the silhouette, you know.
Right.
Oh, it's easy now with digital. You just take the image from the panel before, copy and paste it, and then select it and fill it. Boom,
yep.
silhouette.
Yeah, that's where Photoshop is a beaut, because you can select and then choose under the select menu, condense or compress. I forget. I don't have Photoshop in front of me. But you can either expand or contract. That's
oh, yeah.
the word.
It's under,
and you can contract that selection and then fill it, and then you've got a really nice white border on the inside of your silhouette.
Yeah.
Oh.
Select, modify, contract, or expand.
That's exactly right.
The technical aspects are going to be more useful for you guys to give, because I know how to do it in Flash, but it's not going to mean a lot to anybody.
Hmm.
You would just fill a line border around.
You
everything.
Can be our resident Flash person.
Well, excuse me, but in Flash, it's actually quite easy to do.
Hmm. Chris, could you give the Flash translation of that, please?
Well, let's see. And then it's like, all right, now you need to do a blur. And I'm like, well, you can't do that in Flash. Oh, well.
For our friends in Vectorburg.
Vectorburg.
So who else has a comic craft pet peeve?
Man, I seem like...
I've seems done
like
one
I
and Brad's done one.
I should have a bunch of them.
Hit me, Dave and Chris.
Oh, God. You know what? I'll tell you the big one, though, is that...
Oh, I have a good one.
And this is probably a slow discovery for a younger cartoonist rather than a big pet peeve of mine. But there's there's a balance between text and drawing. And until someone finds that, it is so painful to read the comic.
That was the one I thought of.
One way or the other.
That was the one I thought of. It's the same thing. There, you need to... just because you have an infinite canvas, quote unquote, it doesn't mean you should use it and fill it.
And fill it.
Yeah, and I think what a lot of people forget is that the power of a comic strip is almost in that haiku-like intensity of editing words and editing images, you know? And so you either get an overdrawn, because that's, for a lot of what a comic strip can achieve, it's not about overdrawing and it's not about overwriting. It's about this condensed, powerful 10 to 30 second read that people come back to day after day, you know?
Yeah.
That's a lot of the power and humor altogether, and that is brevity. The more you can, every word that does not add to the punchline subtracts.
That's
and
true,
the shorter
yeah.
and the more and the more concise you can get, the better you are.
That's very true. And in fact, you know, I'll go a step further, is that the more monosyllabic words you can use versus polysyllabic, the funnier your joke is.
Uh-oh, Chris.
Exactly.
No, that's a problem, because the way I've always felt about Vanderbeam's dialogue is that if the reader doesn't read it or skips over some of it, it's okay, because some of the words are supposed to be big. But I know that it's probably, oh, I should know that, but I'm not going to bother. So it is a problem.
It's not an accident that whenever Shakespeare wanted to do comedy with his low characters, he would switch into plain text monosyllabic words. Because there's just something about comedy that works better with ba-dump, 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 rather than ba-da-la-dump, ba-da-la-dump, you know?
I'm so glad we have that recorded.
I think that just works in general as humor. Just those words.
But that having been said, though, there's a type of, like, superfluous, flowery humor, like, you know, that almost over-the-top Victorian, like we were talking about, you know. I say, Jesus, what an absolutely delicious day of scrumptiousness. You know, like, that sort of thing needs and requires a polysyllabic. And that's why Vanderbeam works when he's doing that.
But in general, as a rule for any character, if you have the option of using a two-syllable word instead of a five-syllable one, maybe you should think about it.
Yeah, because right. that's getting really bottle-a-dump.
What am I now I don't have one to add, because that was really the one that bugged me the most, because I can think of a couple of strips where I don't know whether or not they started this way, but the layout of the strip actually changed to accommodate more text, and the staging of the strip changed to accommodate more text. So there's these gulfs of space between characters in order to give him an opportunity to put words in if he needs to.
Mm.
And that is bad. I don't like to read that.
I this is a struggle that I have constantly, and sometimes I want to get a point across, and I find myself breaking it into two panels, because it just feels like people are going to say, oh, okay, and I've spent enough time on this panel, and I'm ready to move on. You know, it's just too much.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and you know what? I'll expound a bit of advice on that score, though. If you know that you're a verbose writer, or you write at length more than other people, don't take the route that I did, which is to use a hand-drawn font. You know you're going to be verbose. Well, no, just for speed of reading, people can read a machine's font
typeface,
faster than they can read a hand font.
Oh, do you think so?
Oh, yeah, I know so. There's so few people that have a font that's a hand font that's as clean or cleaner than a machine font. Can you think of a comic strip that? I mean, maybe Get Fuzzy has a super clean font, and Doonesbury has a very clean font. For better or for worse, has a very clean font.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
But, you know, like, look at Agnes, for example. I don't know if that's the strip you get in your newspaper.
Agnes.
But that font is so dense of a hand font, and I wonder if sometimes I don't fall into that problem with Sheldon. But what I'm saying is if you know that you are going to have a wordy, character-based, verbal sparring repeatedly every day, then you might want to go with a...
I think as guilty of that is Wiley. I don't like his lettering. I mean, it's interesting... But sometimes he's got a lot of words,
yeah,
and I don't want to wade through it.
Well, that's a really good tangent. Hand lettering versus digital fonts. Which way to go? See, for me, it's digital all the way, and I'll tell you why. Because so much of what I've been able to improve on in the last couple of years is editing. And it's really difficult to edit when you're doing hand lettering.
Oh, yeah.
That is definitely true. Yeah, no, I definitely suffer where you guys do not as a hand letterer because my editing is limited once it's drawn. You know, whereas you guys, right before it goes up online, you can still be like, you know what, I'm changing quack to quick. You know, that's great.
I write my final script as I'm typing. I have a general idea of what they're going to say. I never know exactly what they're going to say until I'm typing it.
Yeah, I don't know that either.
It would totally change the dynamic of how I worked if I went to a written font.
Dave, do you script out ahead of time, or is it kind of the same way when you're lettering that you are nailing down what they're saying?
I script on scrap paper or on electronically, like I type it out or something, and then I letter first in pencil and then draw, and then when I go back after penciling or inking, there sometimes will be a second edit between penciling the text and inking the text. So for me, I mean, it's all what you're used to. For me, this works. I can't imagine. I mean, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Douglas Adams books, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There's a character in there who he's this fake character. He's supposedly the greatest poet that ever lived on any planet in the universe. And the reason why he was such a great poet was that he wrote his poetry on these like banana leaves, and so he only had one chance to write them. So they were perfect when he wrote them. And so they, in the book, they go back in time and they send him a word processing computer, and his poetry just comes out like crap. And so I always sort of, for me, that always is sort of the metaphor of how I work, which is if I had too many chances to change it, I would lose that initial spark. And so I try to get it right the first time, and then, and you know, sometimes I fail, obviously, but for me, that's the pattern I use. And I'm not saying that's for everybody, but for me, that's the way it works.
That makes sense, though, as a pattern. Huh.
I got to tell you, Dave.
For me also, because I love the comic strip as a finished physical product, and I sell the originals, and I enjoy selling the originals because I love it when people have them up on their wall. So for me, having the hand lettering on there is like this complete art. It's a complete piece of art.
Right. You don't have to manipulate it or add anything.
And I don't know why, but there's some odd sense of, even if that strip never sells, there's an odd sense of satisfaction in looking at it when it's done, and it's all this one complete image.
Well, then you can put it on your wall, you know?
Well, I got to tell you, Dave, I was just thinking when we brought it up to discuss lettering, and Brad said digital or hand-drawn, and my response is digital for me, but I'm jealous of your hand lettering. I'm completely envious of it. Because it's got a fluidity to it that even the fonts that, you know, I mean, I was going to say, because I was trying to form my answer, as at the same time I was listening to what you guys were saying. And there, one of the things I was going to say is, well, does it really matter now? Because anything you could create to draw, there's a font for it. It's not like, but it's not the same. It's just not the same.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I made a font out of my handwriting. And I used it for Cherry Board Nightmare. I didn't use it for Star Slip. But because I didn't feel like that lettering fit the material, I wanted it to look a little more serious.
But but the S is always the same S. Even though it's your S, it's always the same. We're on, every time Dave draws an S, it's a little bit different. And your eye picks up on it, and it's got a fluid of line to it, much like the art does.
They're doing wonderful things at Blambot, though. The lowercase s is different from the uppercase s.
Oh, man.
Well, speaking about what Scott's talking about, that is true. Dave's hand lettering, if you look at any one Sheldon strip, he's got a really subtle change in it. He's actually doing five or six fonts at the same time. It's just based on what those characters are saying. It goes beyond having a Roman face and a bold face and an italic face. You can look at any two or three Sheldon comics and see that he's using in any one strip maybe five or six different identifiable faces.
That's
true. How about this? How about we end this discussion with a suggestion to our younger listeners? As you younger listeners are coming into cartooning, you will have less and less reasons to ever try hand lettering. It's not like us where we had to do it before and we know what it was like and went through it. I would recommend that all of you, even if you've been using a computer since before you could say the word computer, take your shot at doing hand lettering comic book and comic strip lettering. I think it will help you immensely, even when you're doing your digital stuff. Do you guys agree or disagree?
No, they should. And it doesn't hurt to have good penmanship.
And I think from an art history perspective, I mean, one of the reasons why Picasso could go and take the modernistic risk that he did was because he was classically trained and knew the reasons and the rules that he was breaking when he started to do, you know, what he became famous for. And I think the same is true for cartooning, is that if you understand how text can impact a drawing and vice versa, then you're, even if you end up going completely machine font and text, you know, digital texting, I think you'll have a better understanding of it. I think that's a very good lesson. Yeah,
I agree as well, and I'll tell you why. I think right now, if you take a font into any digital application, you've got controls for kerning and baseline shift and leading and all that other stuff. But until you've actually written out good typography with your own hand, you don't really understand what those words mean. And even if you end up like Scott says, doing digital lettering, it's a really good experience just to give yourself that background. It'll make you a much more powerful user when and if you do switch to digital fonts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what? I'll even say this actually. I think if you start hand lettering before you use machine fonts, if you start by hand lettering, I do think it will teach you lessons about being a better writer. And here's why. Because when you use a machine font, you're so quick to say, up, line break, up, reduce the whole thing from font 12 point to font 11 point. Up, now it fits. I don't need to edit any of that text out. And
right.
So when you're hand lettering, you're forced to say, wait a minute, I have three more words that will fit in this bubble. How do I fix this? And I think that helps you in the long run as a cartoonist.
That's cool. That's really a good idea.
We're at 36 minutes. Do you want to do our tips for the week and then wrap it up?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
All right, so this is the segment where we each give a friendly tip to help your cartooning life go a little bit smoother. And also, if it's like me, it's going to make you say, oh, I didn't know you could do that. Dirt. I've been doing it the hard way.
Are these only technical tips?
No.
All right.
It could be anything.
Well, good.
It could be how to keep your brushes clean.
That's a technical tip.
It is?
That's what I consider technical.
It could be how to write convincing characters.
There you go. All right.
Is that metaphysical enough for you?
I don't think that's the word for it either. Let's just get into the tips.
Hey, let's just get into the tips. Let's start with Dave.
All right. I will do, let's see, I could do two quick tips then this week. My one is for writing, which is for characters. When you're starting a strip, starting a storyline, starting a strip, starting anything, begin your writing point from 20 or 30 seconds after when the conversation started. Starting in medias res makes for a more interesting jumping in point conversationally from characters. Don't start with the, hey, Scott, how are you? Oh, good, Dave, how are you? Hey, did you see the game last night? Yeah, what a game. I think you want to start from the, yeah, what a game. You don't want to start from the, hi, Scott, how are you? So that's just thought number one. And then thought number two is take a look at interesting lines of comic strips that you love. And you'll find, and this is most probably true in political cartoons, you'll find that the weight of the line changes as curves loop around. And look at how that works, and look at how that relates to making the drawing more interesting and how the light falls across a character. You'll find that if a character has a consistent line all across his body, it's a little bit less exciting than if the line gets a little thicker towards the base of a curve or where the light doesn't fall.
Oh, yeah.
It's a nice way of implying shape and light and space. So those are my two tips for the week.
That first one was awesome. Okay, Chris. I mean, not the second one was bad, but... but the first one really, like, knocked me on my butt.
No, it was interesting because I'm thinking about all the opportunities
Have I done that?
He said, what? Like, you can open on that. He doesn't have to be Tom was telling
Plus,
me
Plus, I think
that...
it draws you in more. Like, if someone comes... If a conversation starts off with... I can't believe he did that.
Right.
Then you're automatically like, whoa, what's going on? What happened?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
No, that's an awesome tip.
No, I think we can all agree I'm a genius.
But that second tip. All right.
We're like, we judge the tips that we give.
Go ahead, Chris.
I only have one tip, and it's for the sake of writing. And it's really for the sake of beginning a strip. And it's for when you're just starting out. And this is something I've seen over and over again, is that... people tend to write a strip and they're like, I'm going to write a strip about me and my friends, or, you know, or base it on that. And that's fine. But don't be afraid to make your main character or your main two characters kind of losers. Let them lose. Let them get hurt. Otherwise, they just, you know what I'm saying? They become punchline delivery systems. Yeah. And if you don't have...
It makes them more real.
Yeah, you need some dimension to them. I get tired of cheering on the guy who's always successful. You know?
Right.
So, that's the only one that I can think of, because there's 1,000 GeoCities strips out there that are...
GeoCities?
Yeah, if they're even on GeoCities anymore, but...
Comic Genesis?
Right, where they're like, GeoCities? Well, everybody loves a winner, so my character is always going to have the cool line to say at the end.
In other words, you're talking about can we have more strips where the main character isn't a Ferris Bueller that always wins in the end?
Right, because there's no depth, and I'm not interested in seeing him always win.
Yeah.
I can't relate to him at all.
Right.
So
that's a good one.
That is good. Well, darn it, my tip is so technical now, and everyone has these great... non-technical
tips. When you're carrying a bunch of boxes from the store, keep your keys in your left hand so you can open the door with...
Yeah, so it's even worse. It's like, try to bend at the knee. Don't lift with your back. That's not what makes
your intention.
Is Brad's tip going
to
be technical?
Eat vegetables.
I've got one tip that's going to piggyback on Dave's tip, and then I've got a tip on writing a punchline.
All right, then I'm going to do the technical tip. All right.
No, that's good.
So the technical tip is something that was taught to me recently and has saved me a lot of time. I really enjoy putting in dark black areas in the backgrounds and a lot of spot blacks. But sometimes you lose a lot of your line work when you do that. And so if you have a character that wears, for example, a black shirt, and you know, you do all this great line work, and you know, that shows his arm, and then shows the folds in his shirt. Then you realize the shirt's black and you fill it in and you lose all the line work. So what people normally do is they'll use those lines as white. They'll draw those lines as white.
Mm.
So I guess what you could do is just draw them after you've done all the filling in. But what I was doing was going back and trying to retrace my steps. What I didn't realize was that you could use your selection tool, your magic wand selection tool, in Photoshop to click your line work and save the selection.
I still don't know how to do that.
Well, what you do is you click your line art, get all your lines selected, and then you just, in Photoshop, you go select, save selection, and then name it line art. It's that simple. So then you fill in all of your black areas, fill in all your spot blacks, and you've lost all of your lines. But now you want to go fill them in white, you go select, load selection, and it'll be there in the list. Now you have your little dancing ants from where all your lines were. Take your little white pencil, fill them in. There you
take your little white pencil there. Go ahead and fill in the blacks there.
And the lines you drew and got perfect the first time are now perfectly inversed white.
Nice.
Good job, Scott.
I'd like to make a suggestion for technical tips in the future. I think we should all have to do them in Bob Ross voice.
What you like to do is go to select and save selection.
And you
I like
can
to save
where that flower lives in your comic strip.
I like to,
right there?
Whenever I save line art, I like to call it happy trees.
There are no mistakes. There are no mistakes.
It's my happy trees layer. All right, Brad.
Well, I'm going to piggyback on what Dave said about lines, and that is for one of my two, and this is going to be real quick. Think about how lines can be used to separate foreground from background, how heavier lines around an image will bring it to the foreground, and how you can make other items recede into the backgrounds by drawing them with a lighter line. All right, so that's one thing I want to piggyback on, line quality. Number two, and I'm really happy to find out that so many of us are talking about writing issues, because the tendency for this kind of a thing, whether it's a podcast or a book, is to talk about the mechanics and to leave some of the harder issues like writing off to the side. So I'm really happy to hear all these things that are being talked about with writing.
All right.
Here's my what's that?
All right.
Well, here's my small contribution to that. When you're trying to write humor, humor is based on tension and release. Everything should be built to build up to the punchline, where the punchline itself should always be the very last sentence in your comic, okay, with a few exceptions. And everyone talks about the punchline, but if you're really trying to hone your humor, you should also think about the punch word. And that's the word and the punchline that carries the biggest emotional charge. You should always have your punch word, the last word in your sentence, and you should always have your punchline as the last sentence in your comic. Anything you put after that crucial word is false tension, and that never gets released.
Huh.
No, I think that's true.
Wow, that's interesting, because I almost have an opposite approach to that.
I tended to, but the thing was that I would shore up a weak punchline with two of them.
I almost find myself maybe that shows an insecurity in my humor, but I always find that I like to have the punchline be the second to last thing that is said, and the last thing said is there to reinforce it, to almost
commentary on the joke kind of.
Yeah, thing. Yeah, almost.
But I don't think that works quite so much, because you're building a tension that never gets released, and if you're building and building and building, and you pop that bubble, that should be it.
What I'm trying to find.
It's like listen to Jay Leno talk in his monologue tonight, and you'll see exactly how not to do it. The guy reaches a punchline, and then he
mumbles.
Babbles for another 30 seconds after he reaches the punchline. It's the most annoying thing in the world.
Yeah,
that's true. I read it today. It's true.
OJ Simpson, who knows? Maybe not. Who knows? It's just. You're watching the guy, and it's like, hit the punchline, enjoy the laugh, move on.
But see, now I feel insecure, really insecure. Look at this strip, Chris,
Which one?
Where Brent tells Cole that he's dressed up as Luke Skywalker and he's going to go rescue Jade.
All right, I got to go find it.
And then Cole says, you want to marry your sister? And then there's a pause, and then the punchline is Brent going, ew, and that wasn't enough for me. I had to have Cole say, I'm sure there's someone in the con selling costumes.
Yeah, but I think that can still work. I do. And the other thing is that I understand why Jay Leno does that. And I'm not saying I like it when Jay does it, because I think it's ridiculous. And my favorite moments with him are when the joke does not work, because that him continuing to talk is supposed to be some kind of a bed for the audience laughter, to work under the laughter. You know what I mean? Right. I think that would build it. But sometimes the laughs don't come, and he starts to do his little babble, and then he completely collapses, and it's bad.
Well, maybe then when it works, because I think I do a similar thing when I write jokes. But I'm very interested in thinking about this more, Brad, your idea of the punch word. But I think when it works, when there's a follow up commentary, what you're doing as a cartoonist is the same kind of idea as a stand up, which is you're riding the laughter and trying to just enjoy the moment. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at Dave's.
That dithering moment, and a good stand-up comedian does it well, and a bad stand-up comedian does it poorly. Which is, you're just sort of, you're either kind of repeating the punchline in a different way sometimes, or sometimes you're doing a commentary on a commentary, basically. But I think that's the same impulse that the stand-ups have, where they're sort of commenting while people are laughing.
I'll concede to a point, and that is, I think if a stand-up comedian has to ride the punchline, because he's going to be delivering another punchline pretty soon, so he's got to provide a little bridge there, whereas that's not quite the case with a comic strip. But I really don't like the PVP. I'm looking at it right now, where he says, "I'm sure there's someone in the con selling costumes." Well, that's got a certain amount of content to it. It kind of bolsters the joke. I don't have so much of a problem with that. I guess the ones I really have a problem with is where you hit your punchline, and then there's somebody else in the panel saying, "Yeah, I know,"
Good point,
or something like that. You know, it's worthless. You know, when it's a worthless word balloon that has no place being in there, can easily be edited out. I think you're improving your humor by taking it out.
I think I know what he's talking about now.
Yep. Yeah, I
think that's right. It's like,
but great! I'm the only guy on the panel that needs a translator. That's wonderful.
But that night, I was the guy.
It,
that took us a while.
What I'm trying to say, in not so many words, not to put a fine point on it, you guys suck.
Hey, here's a test.
I think that the great thing here, though, is that, and this is probably something we should acknowledge from the outset, is that there are different approaches to cartooning, and that the best thing we can do is to offer people variety in paths they might not have considered.
Here's your test.
Chris has got a funny example in the queue.
I did, but I'm going to reformat it because I can't think of a good punchline. Can your punchline be made better or worse if there is another character in the panel after the punchline who says, kinda?
Kinda.
Yeah.
If the next guy has a second joke, like if this is the oldest comic strip in the world, and the punchline is to get to the other side, and then the second guy has a second joke, like that situation is most foul, you know, FOWL. then it's okay. But
well,
if it's
you can have a compound punchline, and you can have a stinger too, where you're actually doing two punchlines. You hit the punchline,
and then somebody else
comes in that says something equally.
Then you slap
funny.
It.
You're making me reconsider my stingers.
How about this?
Punching them
how
up.
How about this? Second to last panel. Second to last panel. Punchline. Last panel. The other guy silently eating a sandwich.
All right. I've just created a new character based on this conversation. And it's mine. I'm taking ownership of it. It's Phil, the guy who always ruins the punchline. And then after the punchline, he sticks his head in. He's something like, hey, who wants sandwiches? Yeah.
You guys want to play some basketball?
And then by about Thursday in the week where he's done it repeatedly, when he pops his head on, everybody else like tries to tackle him and wrestle him to the ground before he can ruin the punchline.
We're going to take your cucumber drink, add alcohol to it, and get pickled, and then everyone's laughing, and he comes in. He's like, "Hey, what's going on in here? Hey, what are y'all talking about?"
I heard you guys laughing.
And then it's like,
"Let me ask you guys a specific question, and this might be too specific to Sheldon. But what happens when every line that you write is a punchline?"
I love those jokes.
No one's laughing.
I started to seriously think about it because I can think of strips that are like that.
It's like a panel, nothing but punchlines. It's like Cincinnati, and then the next guy says, only on Wednesdays. And then the next guy says, because my shoes hurt. And then the next guy says, well, here's my thermometer. Where's my pen?
I think, am I being a pig here? As the guy that's been, you know, we've all been doing daily cartoon for a long time. If you've got a strip, it's a four-panel strip, and it's got four punchlines, what you need to do is rewrite that so you've got four different strips.
That is actually true.
That is very true.
But see, on the other side of it, though.
And the moment you realize that you can spin one comic into four is the day that you've got a happy week ahead of you.
That's actually really interesting because.
It's like my writing here is done.
When I did Checkerboard Nightmare.
I've ever drawn, there were three or four jokes in that one strip.
Yeah. When I did Monday, Wednesday, Friday strip, I wanted to put more punchlines in. But now that I'm doing it daily, I'll have two in there, and I'll go, I'm just going to use that one tomorrow.
See, I do this thing called the hidden punchline. It's usually really early in the strip, and it's a little thing that I think only – it's usually a punchline I don't feel is strong enough to be its own punchline, but it tickled me. Like in this current storyline where Brent has already like punched a guy, and she's been kidnapped, and she's stuck in there. And he gives the stormtroopers a slip, and he says something like, "Whew, I gave him the slip. Man, I sure hope Jade appreciates everything I'm doing for her." And it's very but it tickled me because it's like, well, it's been awful what he's put her through today, but he's still like, "I sure hope she appreciates it."
Right.
And it's that little hidden punchline that.
Does that count as a punchline? Because
no.
I used to litter stuff with that.
Yeah.
And I think that really, especially if you have a really obnoxious character. It really fleshes them out, like their thought process.
That is advanced. That's advanced cartooning, sir. Not for the timid. Not for the neophyte. All right, guys, we're coming up on 53 minutes here. I think this has been
Holy
a good
God.
First Webcomics Weekly. So let's remind everyone that's listening where we can find everyone. Dave Kellett can be found at SheldonComics.com. Correct?
Yeah, he's not talking.
I'm sorry. Yes, SheldonComics.com.
He doesn't want people to know.
Brad Geiger, where can we find you at?
I'm at evil-comic.com.
and Christopher Straub.
I'm at starslip.com.
And you can find me at pvponline.com. I found out this weekend, and I actually did this weekend, I did just say that, that legendary comics writer Mark Evanier has a website called Point of View, and it's POV Online.
That's cool.
That's very close to PvP Online.
So what are you trying to say?
I actually typed it in wrong, and I ended up on his site. And I was like, huh? So anyway, look up our stuff, and then if you like it, heed our advice, and if you don't, discard it.
And then get mad and email us.
Well, it looks like another Webcomics Weekly has been...
foisted upon us.
Webbed. We've been webbed. All right. We'll talk to you guys and do it again next week. We're going to do it every Friday?
I'd like to.
Every Friday.
Let's do it.
I'm going to run out of tips, though.
End your week with a Webcomics Week.
Lee.
Oh, man.
Hey, guys, who wants sandwiches?
See you later.
We'll see you later. Lee.
Lee. Oh, man.
Hey, guys, who wants sandwiches?
See you later.
We'll see you later.